In the darkness, as an empty cab rolled by. Then all at once I heard the sound of yuppies in the sky.
And the herd came down Columbus for as far as I could see. All the men were wearing polo and the women wore a spree. Each yuppie had a Walkman, and as each one passed me by, I saw their sad expressions, and I heard their mournful cry.
Condos for sale.
Another Peter, Paul, and Mary, Yuppies in the Sky from Flowers and Stones. Story from March 26th, San Francisco Chronicle, State High Court Limits Cash Bail System by Bob Agelko. California's cash bail system for pretrial release, preserved by the voters in November, was cut back substantially Thursday by the state Supreme Court, which said judges in most cases must consider a defendant's ability to pay before setting bail in any amount. Quote, no person should lose the right to liberty simply because that person can't afford to post bail, Justice Mariano Florentino Cuillar said in a 7-0 ruling in the case of a San Francisco man held in jail for a year on a robbery charge. Newly released defendants can often be released safely with supervision by electronic monitoring, regular check-ins with a pretrial case manager, and community housing, as well as drug and alcohol treatment, Cuillar said. When a judge determines that cash bail is necessary, he said the judge, quote, must consider the arrestee's ability to pay the stated amount of bail and may not effectively detain the arrestee solely because the arrestee lacked the resources to post bail. And before holding a defendant without bail, Cuellar said, the judge must find by, quote, clear and convincing evidence that pretrial detention is necessary to protect the public or to prevent the defendant from fleeing before trial. California law allows judges to set bail based on the seriousness of the charges, this is the current law, and the defendant's record, a system that has kept hundreds of thousands of low-income defendants in jail awaiting trial, while those who could afford bail were released. We've had the case of Aaron Hosmer, who's came to the Huff meeting and talked about losing his vehicle because he was in jail and couldn't get around to get it out, pay for it, before the expenses mounted up to too much. I think that was it. Maybe it was even sold before he could get out. Anyway, the story continues here somewhere. 2018 state lawmakers approved legislation SB 10 to abolish the cash bail system and allow judges to decide for all but the most serious crimes whether defendants should be freed without bail while awaiting trial. But bail bond companies blocked this measure from taking effect in 2019 by qualifying a referendum for the ballot, spending $3 million to collect signatures. And last November, 55% of the voters rejected Proposition 25, which would have put the no-bail law into effect. Bail bond companies' chief source of income is the non-refundable 10% fee they charge to defendants for posting bail. The court case involved a San Francisco man, Kenneth Humphrey, now 66. He is accused of entering the apartment of a 79-year-old man who lived in the same building in May 2017, threatening to put a pillowcase over his head and stealing $5 and a bottle of cologne. A judge initially set bail at $600,000 based on the charge and Humphrey's record, then lowered it to $350,000. But Humphrey remained in jail until May 2018 and then was freed without bail after the First District Court of Appeal said judges must consider defendants' finances in setting bail. His charges are still pending. Humphrey was, quote, thrilled by the ruling, San Francisco public defender Manu Raju told reporters. He said Humphrey, since his release, has been a mentor and a counselor to inmates in similar circumstances. In August, the state Supreme Court ordered all trial judges in California to follow the appeal court's standard on bail consideration while Humphrey's case was under review. But defense lawyers said compliance has been mixed at best, and Thursday's ruling should send a stronger message against unnecessary detention. There was a lot of disagreement among judges about the meaning of the appellate ruling, said Alec Kara Katansansis. I got that one wrong, but forgive me, Alex, of the nonprofit Civil Rights Corps, who argued the case before the Supreme Court. We've got a long way to go. Thursday's ruling did not go as far as SB 10, as the court allowed judges to set bail in some cases. But those situations are likely to be much less frequent when judges must consider a defendant's financial resources, effectively barring cash bail for many low-income arrestees. And the court's requirement of clear and convincing evidence will make it harder for judges to hold defendants without bail unless a defendant is charged with murder or another life sentence as crime. And also, it should be said that SB 10, which initially was supported by the ACLU, I think was eventually there was other disagreement inside the ACLU, or they backed off because it gave judges too much power to use algorithms that would eventually might have a disparate racial impact. I don't have a lot of details on that one, but there was some concern about that, and I don't know if what kind of methods would be used to determine clear and convincing evidence, I guess, is a standard. I'm not quite sure. Well, let's see if I have any sense of that. Of clear and convincing, according to the Supreme Court in Colorado versus New Mexico, 1984 case says, it means that evidence is highly and substantially more likely to be true than untrue, and the fact finder, whether it's the jury or the judge, must be convinced that the contention is highly probable. So it's a high standard, perhaps not as high a standard as beyond a reasonable doubt, and it's a higher, certainly a higher standard than preponderance of the evidence, which is just 51%. Legal fans. The story continues about the changes in the bail system. Cash bail will be much less common under the ruling, said Lara Bazelon, a University of San Francisco law professor who filed arguments for a group of legal scholars opposing the current bail system. Trial judges will have to go to much greater lengths to justify detaining someone. She said the bail system also has the effect of coercing many people, and this is true in Santa Cruz, I think, particularly among low-income people, into accepting guilty plea agreements that allow their release. A lot of people plead to things they didn't do just to get out, many of them racial minorities, Bazelon said. Or poor people, I would add. On the other side, attorney Kimberly Stapledon of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, which urged the court to uphold the current system, said increasing pretrial release also increases potential dangers to crime victims and the public. They can't be 100% sure these conditions of supervision are going to work, Stapledon said. She said judges already have the authority to release defendants without bail based on their record and the charges against them. But David Quintana, a lobbyist for the California Bail Agents Association, which is kind of interesting, said the ruling was thoughtful and fair to all sides. You would think that if he's a representative of the Bail Agents Association, he would be concerned about them losing a large source of income. But in any case, the story concludes, on a typical day, Quilar said in the ruling, nearly 500,000 people sit in jails across the United States awaiting trial. In California, he said, a 2015 study found that the typical bail amount was $50,000, more than five times the national average. The accused retains a fundamental constitutional right to liberty, Quilar said. He said that the state's proper concern in setting conditions of pretrial release is not to punish. It is to ensure the defendant appears at the court proceedings and to protect the victims as well as the public from further harm. And that's Bob Agelko's story in the Friday Chronicle, State High Court Cuts Back Cash Bail System. And here's an LA Times story off the net. The Echo Park homeless camp is gone. What exactly did L.A. achieve? Emily Alpert Reyes and Doug Smith and Benjamin Oreskes wrote the story about 12 hours ago, according to this. When the city swiftly fenced off Echo Park and prodded people out of a sprawling camp that had taken root along its scenic lake, it was an extraordinary move in a city full of homeless encampments. Nighttime crews hustled to erect a metal fence wrapped in green fabric around the park. Police descended and ejected irate protesters. Outreach workers were sent out to offer hotel rooms and other shelter to homeless people before a looming deadline to vacate the soon-to-be-shuttered park. Of course, there are never any specifics about how many people were actually offered this and for how long, because this is, of course, their PR cover, and the people in the media, particularly the LA Times, apparently, seem to be quite happy playing along with this fantasy and facade. Even some of the dwindling numbers of people who lingered in the encampment this week were taken aback by the similar effort focused on Echo Park, as hundreds of homeless camps remain in other neighborhoods and parks. If the city claimed to be helping people, asked Isabel Castro, why were they zeroing in on so intently on this one encampment? Go take a walk at MacArthur Park, Castro urged this week outside her tent. See if you truly care for the people. Uprooting the Echo Park camp drew protests, condemnation from the American Civil Liberties Union, and even criticism from some within City Hall. On Thursday night, police arrested 182 protesters and briefly detained journalists, including an LA Times reporter. But in some corners of the city, residents were envious, wanting to know why the same moves had not been made in their neighborhoods. Progressive activists, in turn, fear the aggressive attack at Echo Park could become a playbook. At a press conference Friday, Mayor Eric Garcetti framed the effort as a success, calling it the largest housing transition of an encampment ever in the city's history. He suggested in some cases it could be replicated. Nobody dreamed that we'd be able to house more than 200 people when they started, the mayor said. Of course, my response is, if it was really good housing, I suspect the people who are in the encampment might be willing and interested in going to it. But forcing people away and dispersing them with temporary motel rooms of an indeterminate number for an indeterminate length of time doesn't give me a lot of confidence that they're being candid, honest, or fair in what they're doing. Councilman Joe Buscaino, who represents a district that stretches from Watts to San Pedro, also praised the Echo Park effort, saying in a written statement, "I got my house. I don't give a shit about you." No, he said that the approach of intensive outreach followed by a choice date must become the standard if we are going to move people living on our streets into a better situation. In other words, as long as they give them little pieces of paper and claims that they're going to be providing things and then a deadline, that's just fine for evicting people, even in the middle of a COVID epidemic, and Los Angeles is still in that situation. It's crazy shit. "We no longer have the luxury to wait until people are ready," Buscaino said. And why is that, Buscaino? Because you don't want to spend money on decent housing? In Venice, Brian Averill and his newly formed group are pushing Councilman Mike Bonin to undertake a similar effort to remove a beachfront encampment that has grown to more than 200 tents. "Venice is a powder keg right now," Averill said. "We need to see the city take some step to show they're serious right now. We haven't seen it." The Venice Boardwalk Action Committee is proposing a 4-week program to conduct extensive outreach involving LA City Sanitation, County Mental Health, and the LAPD to find housing for 250 people and then keep the beach free of tents. I'm sure those people are going to be really successful as they go about with their telescopes looking for housing, but probably more successful in frightening people off the beaches and arresting those who are who remain. Averill said the Echo Park closure could be a model, but said he hoped that we learn from the mistakes Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell made over there with the police presence. Venice resident Brian Lindner, who goes to the boardwalk regularly to cycle and swim, said he got involved in such efforts after his daughter was approached by a drunken homeless person. The Echo Park closure gave him some hope, he said, although he wondered if it would also push more homeless people toward Venice. "For the Venice Beach Boardwalk, can something like that happen to get that back into useful condition?" he said. Because, of course, having homeless people there means that no one can use it because those homeless people are like a bunch of locusts, right? Echo Park Lake is hardly the place where LA has sought to clear a homeless encampment, hardly the first place, but it became a flashpoint for many reasons. Homeless activists defined the camp as a community and mobilized others, including Echo Park residents who aren't homeless, to rally to their cause. Angelenos troubled by the encampment in turn were emotionally invested in a beloved park that had undergone tens of millions of dollars in renovations years earlier. In other words, let's support the parks, screw the people. Not an unusual approach. I'm not sure how many privileged residents on next door badly want to reclaim an alley in South L.A., said Bill Prisluki, executive director of the progressive group Ground Game L.A. Caving to that pressure is part of how we got to the response we saw. Another factor is who leads the council effort. O'Farrell, who represents the area, drove the decision to temporarily close the park, arguing that it had become a chaotic and dangerous place where assaults and other criminal activity flourished. The closure would allow for repairs. I noticed in this story there are no stats about the danger, the assault rate, or the criminal activity. That's true. A drunken man approached a little girl, or a girl. I don't know how little she was. The situation was never intended to last indefinitely, he said of the park encampment. With hotel rooms and shelter beds being offered, he said, it's long past time to move on, and that is exactly what we are doing. So he claims. Others on the council have criticized the move. The sudden closure of the park, the massive LAPD presence, the use of force against protesters, the enclosure of unhoused people who are in the process of placement into hotel shelters, none of it needed to happen, said Councilwoman Nithya Raman, who visited Echo Park amid the furor. Meanwhile, some residents in her district said they were frustrated that Raman had not taken similar action to eliminate an encampment along Borendo Street in Hollywood, which has spurred complaints about illegal activity. She has time to show up for a photo op in Echo Park, but she cannot come down and meet with the neighbors who have been asking for months to meet her face-to-face, she said Charlie Collins, who said he is part of a committee concerned about encampments in Los Felix and Hollywood. A Raman spokesman said her staff have regularly met with the Borendo residents and that the councilwoman had visited the encampment and agreed to a Zoom meeting with neighbors. In Boyle Heights, Veta Gashke said she would welcome the city doing in Hollenbeck Park what had been done in Echo Park. Sounds like the LA Times writers are organizers for sweeping the parks. A homeless camp has persisted there for years and disabled the park restrooms, Gashke said, which of course means they're simply not repairing restrooms that have been, that are now out of order or not providing adequate restrooms, is my usual response to the closed for vandalism crap, the kind of signs that are, well, it does result in a lot of crap, actually, that are placed on the facilities that, for one reason or another, the city wishes to close. So here in Santa Cruz, for example, they've closed the city council bathrooms, and even though they were supposed to remain open by resolution, one of the few good things that Justin Cummings did as he inappropriately supported the closure of the Loudoun Nelson bathrooms here in Santa Cruz. We want help for them, that is, the people in Hollenbeck Park, in Los Angeles, wherever that is. But they can't just be taking over the park, said Gashke, who works with a group called Organized Blocks of Boyle Heights. They argue that the residents should all be offered housing, and if they choose not to go, they should be forced out. And one wonders if she were offered that kind of housing, she would take it. I don't know. And I'm not sure kind of what housing she's talking about or that they're offering. And maybe I'll give a call to somebody down there and see if I can get some information. Some homeless people elsewhere in the city said they envied the way protesters had rallied behind the Echo Park Lake encampment. When they kicked us out, there weren't a lot of people here, said Tammy Vindiola, who said she had been ejected from a street in South Los Angeles. There were the police. Although Garcetti praised the efforts at Echo Park, he specified that such an approach would work when we need to do public works improvements or restore parks. However, in most places, we're not going to have that situation, he said. And there's no mention of specific improvements being required at Echo Park in this story anyway, but who knows? Shayla Myers, senior attorney with the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles, said she was worried this is not an isolated strategy. Singling out particular camps, flooding them with interim resources to house people temporarily, and then barring people with fences, signs, or policing is incredibly dangerous, she argued. Hotel rooms offered through Project Roomkey, for instance, are an incredibly scarce resource, and the city is deploying that resource at the whim of council members, not to the most vulnerable residents, Myers said. It's a strategy to address the visible evidence of homelessness, but it does nothing to solve the crisis. More than a day after the city fenced off Echo Park, the last residents to remain, Ayman Ahmed and David Bush Lilly, I think I know him, were arrested Friday morning after spending a final night along the lake. Along Sunset Boulevard, the chaos of recent days seems to have dissipated. Steps from where police had encircled and arrested protesters along with journalists, the back patio of the Stories Books and Cafe, was packed with patrons. A few buildings away, outside the back entrance to O'Farrell's district office, former park resident Valerie Zeller argued with her new husband Henry as he tried to coax her into sorting through the few possessions she had gotten out of the park. The couple had gotten married in the park last weekend. If you don't decide what we should store, we're going to have to carry it, Henry said. The couple, who had slept Thursday in an alley, were later connected with a room for the night outside the fenced park. Police were preventing former residents of the encampment from returning to look for their valuables. One woman yelled that she needed to get inside to find her birth certificate. Beyond the police tape, dozens of sanitation workers in white suits divided the park into zones and mapped out the tents before sorting through them, a fraught process of categorizing what are personal belongings and what is trash or hazardous waste. Things that were deemed to be personal items went into trash bags, which then went into storage boxes, headed for a downtown facility where they could eventually be retrieved. You can get down there, and if you get in at the proper hours, and if they happen to save it, and if they can find it, and so forth. The crews hope to finish the job Friday. I actually know very little about L.A. storage. I'm talking about my experience in Santa Cruz. The crews hope to finish the job Friday and brought in floodlights so they could work deep into the night. In one of the large yellow dumpsters sat a poster that read, "Welcome to our wedding, Valerie and Henry, March 20th, 2021. And that's a story in the L.A. Times originally, which I'm reading online. The Echo Park homeless camp is gone. What exactly did L.A. achieve? All right, so we're on the line with Peggy Lee Kennedy down with the, the Venice Justice Committee, is that right?
Yes, it is.
And you are, you were doing media outreach, so you weren't actually at Echo Park, but you are familiar with some of the people who were, and you've kind of been keeping a close eye on it, is that fair to say?
I would say it's fair that I've been watching it, but not from the inside. I was trying to support the effort with media, you know, social media and stuff.
Uh-huh. Well, tell us, for the uninitiated, I just read an L.A. Times story about the aftermath, about their, you know, they 2 days after they, you know, fenced it off and sent in the workers to take everybody's stuff and trash it, or supposedly retrieve it and store it, which I expressed some skepticism about. Give us a kind of a chronology. What happened at Echo Park, and what's happening elsewhere in Los Angeles to similar encampments?
So, Echo Park Lake, and honestly, I think the media, the internet media of Knock, you know, like K-N-O-C-K, Knock, they wrote a very comprehensive timeline of what happened. Huh. And I'll send you a link to it. But the fact is that the city council person over that area, Mitch O'Farrell, is really into, you know, supporting luxury development, and he really caters to all the NIMBYs and stuff. And the people that were living in Echo Park Lake, really, they tried to meet with him. There was a lot of organizing there. They really they said, you know, we need housing, not band-aids, and it was a real community. Also, there in that park, there's a lot of vendors, low-income vendors and families that were that park. It's festive, very nice. It's not dangerous like I think the media put it out to be. It was quite lovely, actually, with all the different kinds of people. But the area has been gentrified, and like many areas in Los Angeles that are catering to the high-end development, and they wanted the people in the tents gone so badly. Bringing in just like 400 riot cops, and it was just quite insane how they did it. It's a big park, by the way. You fence the entire park off.
How big is it, let's say, in terms of city blocks?
I don't know, but it's big. I mean, you can look on the internet, I'm sure. I don't know the size of it, but it's a good size, really good size park. That's a lot of fencing. What they did, they spent the entire night fencing. So,
how many people were affected by the removal?
I have no idea, because that park is used by a huge amount of people, not just people living in tents. but there was a considerable amount of people living in tents. Mm-hmm. Then there's the vendors, street vendors. Then there's the families that would go there and barbecue because they don't have outdoor areas to be in, you know, with their kids and their family. So it was a very well-used community park. And so what Mitch O'Farrell did, a little while back, is he put in this, city council motion to use all this money to refurbish the park. Well, you know, you don't need to close an entire park to refurbish it, and that was just a ruse because, you know, they could have just sectioned off small parts and fixed it and then gone to the next one. But no, they staged not too far away a huge amount of police. Like I said, there was around 400 at least. And they had arrest buses, and like I said before, people had been organizing in this park. Street Watch LA had been organizing. So somebody saw the police staging not too far away, a lot of them. And they had the arrest buses, and so all the activists responded to this by coming to the park and to try and protect the people that were living there in the tents. It is quite heroic and amazing. Mostly young people did this. They tried to join arms to block them, but, you know, the force was too much. And I think around 140 people may have been arrested initially on Wednesday night, and then they had the fences going up and all the cops with the fences going up at the same time. They spent all night, all the way till Thursday morning putting up this fence. It's so much, I can't even believe it. I've never seen anything like that in my whole time of homeless activism. But that night, I guess, they came in after they fenced it off and they arrested all the activists. They came in, and the few people that were still left in the park, they offered them shelter. Some of them, they offered them hotel rooms, but then they, you know, drove them to a shelter. And when you go to these hotel rooms and shelters, you can't bring all your stuff. You know, you have a limited amount of stuff. But I guess the couple of days before that, they were trying to get people, because we knew that it was threatening that they were going to do this. No notice was put up. None. No notice. The notices went up approximately 10:30 Wednesday night, when the cops were already there, full riot gear, crazy. They shot people with the less lethal shotgun things, and it was pretty wild. Point blank, pointing them at people. The activists were very brave, but, you know, they arrested all these people and they fenced up the park. And I guess some of the people that were still inside in their tents, really scared, they went in, and they had these kind of bullies that were working with them that are supposed to be from this place, this organization called Urban Alchemy, and they're supposed to be all trauma based, you know. Nice, trauma-based, but they're really working with the cops.
Was there any attempt by attorneys like your friend Carol Sobel and others to get an injunction to stop the cops, given the COVID-19 situation and the shelter-in-place recommendations?
Too fast. There were the National Lawyers Guild, legal observers were there, and there were Legal Aid Foundation was there. Their stuff, but it happened. It was too fast, Robert. It happened really fast. It was a very disgusting, horrible thing. They're lying, saying that they gave all these people hotel rooms. It's a big fucking lie. And they said, oh, they were working with these people for months, which is another big fucking lie. It was this huge last-minute threat. You know, the cops are going to come, and they really did come. And we're gonna get you if you don't kind of go. And people were scared. They got some of the people in hotel rooms. Some, you know, but like I say, you can't take all your stuff. And then they got, I guess, they offered some people shelters and not near there. And then some people turned it down and just left, tried to leave the park. It was a struggle because there was, you know, they wouldn't let you in. So there were, you know, like Shayla Myers from Legal Aid was trying to help get their stuff. It was kind of a wild scene, but the two people that were left in their tents after all was said and done were arrested after midnight, early Thursday morning, and one was David, and the other one's name is Eamon, and I don't know his last name. And they were arrested, but a lot of people were arrested. That's not the only people arrested. So they were arrested. They came in with their urban alchemy, not trauma-based people. and they were like, okay, we have shelter. And then they tried to have a discussion with them that they didn't want to go into some happy congregate shelter. And so they didn't listen. They just arrested them. And that was how it went. And then they were released, I guess, about 10, 12 hours later in the next Thursday morning. Fences are all up. They still had tons of doing selfies with each other. It was so gross. It's really gross.
Now, the person who was, one of the people who was, one of the people.
The sanitation people, tractors, trash trucks, and the whole nine yards. Just get whatever people stuff that had to get left there. Through the whole scene, is most of it got thrown away.
So one of the people that was arrested, you mentioned, was David Busch, who is a longtime L.A. activist. Is he released? Are they being charged? Do we have any sense of what's going on there?
They're charged. They've been charged, and I'm not exactly sure what the charges are, but I know multiple charges. So I don't know what the charges are, but they were released the next morning.
The other question I have for you is, was there any actual sort of discussion of trying to get an injunction? Because surely, though the police mobilized for this quickly, there was presumably some anticipation that this might happen. And up here in Santa Cruz, you know, there was a similar situation with San Lorenzo Park, and we're facing a hearing in 2 days where they're likely to move people out of the park into the nearby benchlands, and then presumably out of the benchlands into the nowhere land, which is the usual. But, I mean, was there much preparation for a possible injunction? Is that being considered at other parks?
I just don't think it was possible. It was a lot going on at once. So I think that the main prep that people could even do was to go there and try and resist at that point.
Now, we did that here in Santa Cruz as well, but the resistance was included an injunction. Is there any preparation for that in other parks?
I think it's really scary right now, and there's discussion about what's going on because the other city council people, some of them are really pushing for this to be done in other areas, and even in areas where the city council people aren't going to push for it, the NIMBYs are cheering it on. It's a horror scene because, I mean, it's a big arse city. You know, it's huge. You got the valley, San Fernando Valley. There's encampments all over. And then the South Bay guy, Joe Buscaino, he is a major dick. So he's probably just, you know, drooling over this. Such a horrible, horrible person. So, because he does these sweeps regularly, just this nap. So what's happening is it's sort of based on what council district you live in, on how nasty it is already. But even if your council person in your district isn't wanting to do this, isn't going to, you know, trying to do this, the haters are lobbying for it. So it's pretty scary. And I think, you know, people are discussing it right now.
Is there much response from, you mentioned young people and others, activists, moved in to attempt to resist this. Is that likely to happen in other parks as well?
I hope so. I really do, because, you know, I mean, we got, the situation is so out of control in L.A. There's just encampments everywhere, and the parks are really, I would say, of the places that people should be camping, they should be in the parks, because that's where the public facilities are. You know, you're not going to get to go in a business and use their bathroom most of the places in L.A. because there's so many people living outside now.
Now, were the bathrooms in Echo Park kept open during this time?
No, that was a huge controversy. You know, the city council person, Mitch O'Farrell, he's, like, really nasty. He said, oh, we're keeping it open. What he did, he lies. He's just always lying. And then there's, like, an armed guard there keeping it closed. So, no, it was kind of, it's a nasty situation. So, but in Venice, at a couple of the places, they have, you know, they bring in porta potties during the day, or they have already existing bathrooms there, and they might leave one or two open. So there's some restrooms. Mm-hmm.
Now, I know in the past, Peggy, we've talked about the Coastal Commission and its impact, at least up in Santa Cruz, although that may be diminishing now, in stopping the criminalization of people in RVs and vehicles through using coastal zone access as a protection. Any news down there about how the city and either through Coastal Commission or through activist activity or legal response or direct activist action has had protecting people in vehicles who are using vehicles as their housing?
A stop with the citations and the tows for a while based on COVID, but they kicked it back up with a vengeance, and the parking tickets are a racket, and most of the streets, even in the coastal area, have these signs up, no parking between 2 and 6 in the morning if your vehicle is oversized, and oversized, the height is 7 feet. So, you know, you don't have to be that tall. Your vehicle doesn't have to be that tall to violate this. So there's a lot of people that get parking tickets, and they build up. And the only relief, besides paying them, you know, is this program through the Department of Transportation in the city of L.A. If you say you're homeless, you could get up to $1,500 worth of your parking tickets, paid off somehow or excused. If you do this very small amount of community service work, and they'll even send a thing into the DMV so that it doesn't stop your getting your DMV, but the process is insane to even get through, because you have to have a place to do the community service. Like, okay, so let's put it this way: St. Joseph's is the place on go-to social service agency where you would go to initiate the process to get your through the Department of Transportation program. You have to go through there. They give you a number, they put you through this process, then you go to the Department of Transportation, and then you have to find a place to do your community service, right? Which all of that is impossible because we have a legal clinic. We take infractions. And St. Joseph's, I've told them over and over and over again, we can't handle the parking tickets. That's what you have to help them with. And they continually send people to our clinic, which is, nobody's getting paid. They're all funded, you know, at St. Joseph's, and they keep sending the people with parking tickets over to us. It's pretty bad. It's sad and sorrowful, and a lot of people get towed. And once that happens, you know, it's because of the fees and everything, those parking tickets one ticket could be well over $200 once, you know, it goes
now,
up there.
Now, one of the concerns I've had, I think I may have talked to you about this. I don't know. It's been a while since we've talked. But we, of course, had the Martin versus Boise decision up in Idaho. And, of course, your old Jones settlement, which I guess what it ran out. And then there was what's been happening for folks who are, you know, independently of the COVID crisis, because COVID will, I don't know if it's likely to soon be over, but they may claim it is soon over soon. And that may be the basis for resuming, you know, as I think you're suggesting is happening, you know, sweeps of people and harassment of people in their vehicles and so forth. But what about the general situation around, you know, Jones and Martin versus Boise? And, you know, you've done a lot of work around, you know, monitoring this.
It's a huge concern. It is a huge concern. So they've sort of been honoring Jones mostly, even though probably going to try to not honor it.
Explain to people what Jones is, Peggy.
Okay, well, first of all, Martin v. Boise was quite a bit built on the Jones decision. So Jones was a landmark lawsuit you know, basically the decision said it's an Eighth Amendment violation, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals really scolded the city of L.A. because they were torturing people. This municipal code, it's a sit-lie law, LAMC 41.18D, right? So, anyway, it's a sit-lie law. So, what happened is even though the Ninth Circuit was successful and the decision was really good, and really it had a lot to do with Martin and everything, but the city of L.A. is quite evil, and they wanted to appeal it to, I guess, the California Supreme Court. And so at that point, it didn't look like a good thing lost the ruling, and so they entered into a settlement agreement. So the Jones settlement basically is that until they build so many shelters, beds in L.A., whatever, that people could sleep on a sidewalk between 9 at night and 6 in the morning. And that's conditioned based on if they're not blocking the sidewalk, not near an entrance, and blah, blah, blah. So prior to COVID, they were tents down at in the morning. You couldn't put your tent up until 9 at night unless it was, like, raining or really cold. And that was pretty gray how they interpreted that. Like, they could have everybody take their tents down and then it's just pouring on your ass. So, it was something. And then COVID hit, and they've not been doing the tents down. So what they've done now is they go through with these sweeps, and they call them CARE, C-A-R-E. And that stands for something. I don't know what, but it's bullshit. Before they called it HOPE, right? It's bullshit. So the city has created this huge industry around, I'm not kidding, a huge industry of all this staff wearing hazmat suits and all this equipment and independent contractors and whatever, all this shit. And they go through these sanitation events, right? And since COVID, they still do the sanitation events. Some of the city council people, the evil ones, are making people get their tents down and relocate. And, you know, there's 60 gallon property law. Anyways, there's a lot of shit going on. But the evil ones are doing the comprehensive cleanups. That's what they call them. We call them fucking sweeps.
So,
they call it spot care, spot clean. Now, in the spot clean, it's ADA. So your tent has to be 36 inches space away from the edge of the sidewalk. So there's, you know, it's not a perfect system, but at least it's better than the horrible city councils that are, but you know, all that's probably going to end as COVID, as they say, oh, COVID's over. So it's a scary situation. right now because so many people are living in tents now.
Hmm. So have you been following this or recording this, sort of this progress or retrogression or whatever it is, online with periodic accounts yourself? Can people read about this if they want to hear more?
I don't think so. I just have a Facebook group and then Twitter.
You're breaking up. Say that again.
We have a private Facebook group and then a Twitter account, which is Venice Justice One. So that's about it. These days.
Huh. So you can't get onto the Facebook unless you join up. But you can do Twitter if you know how to do that, which somebody offered to teach me that one years ago, and I kind of opted out. But
well, it'd be great if somebody volunteered to help us with our website, but it just, who has time at this point? So much going on.
How about a public Facebook page?
Well, that's not great. I could do that, but you just don't know how much hate there is.
Believe it, yeah.
I'd be just talking for all this time.
I hear you.
Just the haters are, they rule them, and they're so evil.
So I'd ask you more, but I'm running out of voice and time both. More voice than time. I do want to have, I've got a question or two for you, which I'm going to ask you off mic, but is there anything you want to kind of conclude with for the publicized version of this discussion?
No, it's just that we keep fighting and standing up against this, you know, creeping fascism, this neo-fascism. We have to keep resisting it. What happened in Echo Park late is nothing less than a fascist police invasion, what happened there. So I think everybody should know that, and the press is not telling the truth about what really happened. People were not housed. They had a police invasion.
Thank you, and we've been talking with?
Peggy Lee Kennedy with Venice Justice Committee.
Cool. Thanks, Peggy.
Burn up the heavens.
From Peter, Paul, and Mary's Flowers and Stones, and that one was called Coming of the Roads. So there.